iCarumCast.com.
It's iCarumCast.
So welcome to the iCarumCast episode 8. I'm very, very excited to have Steve Gaynor, the cinematographer of a wide variety of films that I've been a fan of growing up, and also a co-worker on the Marvel Comics Lionsgate Films picture, The Punisher Warzone, which we worked on together last winter. I guess it's almost a year ago. Welcome to the program.
It has been a year. Isn't that amazing?
Steve and I became fast friends. I knew going into the project that you had worked on a lot of Larry Clark films and Greg Araki films that I really loved. And I didn't really tell you that at first, but we seemed to get along anyways because we shared a mutual love for Blade Runner.
Yeah, wasn't it fantastic, the timing that the movie was actually re-released and we got to go to the theater and see it?
I know. I looked at the way that you were lighting the picture. I think I went up to you and I said, you don't happen to be a fan of Ridley Scott's little android movie.
You know, our director, Lexi Alexander, had already mentioned to me that you were a huge Blade Runner fan. And, you know, I was watching the film probably at least four times a week at that point, simply because Jordan Cronenberg's cinematography on the film is exquisite and is as fine, as I think, as any cinematography on any film of all time. It's really in my top two or three.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it would be silly, given the material that we were dealing with and the genre, not to have some of those elements intertwined into the photography and art design as well.
Was that a new style for you to take on, or is that something that has influenced all the films that you've done?
I think it's been with me the whole time. It's just you have to have a certain amount of resources, meaning money, in order to create something on that scale. You know, there were times there when we were lighting two or three, four blocks at a time, and having the power to be able to bring that illumination simply requires the time and the money. I've shot somewhere around 30 other independent films, as you mentioned, with Larry Clark and Araki and John Waters and all those very interesting people, but they generally don't have very much cash to do those films. And so in that respect, you have to figure out a way to get something unique looking within the scope. And this time Lexi said, here's a much bigger checkbook, make it look fantastic. And, you know, she really, after I had shown her a few examples of stuff of kind of where I thought I would go with it, she really let me run with it. Even though I kept checking back, I was like a nervous schoolboy coming back and, okay, Lexi, is this okay? She'd be like, it's great, go for it, do it.
One of the things that happens as a result of a film like Blade Runner is you get hundreds of copycats, and everybody's been trying to remake Blade Runner ever since it came out and never quite succeeded at matching it. What were the dangers of taking on that style for Punisher so that you didn't get slotted into another wannabe Blade Runner? How did you do it differently? Where did you take it further than what happened with that film?
I think our biggest difference, well, I mean, there are many differences. First of all, let me start by saying that it would be impossible to re-photograph Blade Runner, simply because Jordan Cronenberg was an artist who had a specific vision, and if you're given the same paints on the same canvas, even though you can paint something that is like a Van Gogh, it's not a Van Gogh, you know? So the same goes with filmmaking. The primary difference between what I did and what he did, aside from, you know, the fact that I think he's an incredible artist and I'm an emerging artist, I infused a lot more color into it. And the color was something that we designed based on the way that the comic book actually looked. We looked at the Marvel Max series of comics, Lexi and I, and Andrew Nescaramne, our production designer, very talented man too, and we looked at the comics that Marvel provided with us, and they sent us thousands and thousands of cutout pages of the Max comic. We looked at them, we made our judgments, and we started testing. Now, in Montreal, I don't know that you were necessarily around at that point, but, you know, the primary bad guy in the movie is Jigsaw. I think everybody's aware of that now.
Yeah.
And Jigsaw had this prosthetic makeup. Prosthetic makeup is, at times, can be very difficult to photograph to make it look proper. So I managed to wiggle in a bunch of film tests under the guise of we're testing the Jigsaw makeup, And so during those tests, I had my gaffer, who's my chief lighting person, rig an enormous grid of lights with a bunch of different colored gels on it. And each time we'd shoot, you know, we'd say, turn to your left, turn on the red lights. We'd shoot the red. Okay, great. Turn to your right, turn on the blue. And there's a huge variety of color palette available in lighting gels. So we tested all these things because, you know, not everything looks fantastic on film. To your eye, a certain color might look nice, but the way that the film sees things can be significantly different than what your eye sees. So we went through all these different color gels. We got these our color palette that we were happy with, and then we went through the script and said, okay, this scene, because of where it's based and what it's about, wants to be more of an orange tone scene or wants to be more of a green tone scene.
What difference does it make shooting the actual scene with the super-powered lit gels versus doing it in post? If you wanted such an extreme color palette, why didn't you just tint it afterwards?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And there's actually a relatively simple answer, and that is that when you're doing something in post, in the what we call the DI, which is the digital intermediate suite, and that's when you have an enormous array of controls that allow you to modify the image in so many ways, including color and contrast and gamma and all these different terms. The color itself is, if you're forcing it into the image in the digital suite, then other things tend to go awry. If you're pulling out, let's say, for instance, if you want to remove the green, then the whole image starts to turn magenta, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you put the green in, then the magenta goes out. However, if you use a lighting gel, you're able to delineate certain areas of the frame with that color while allowing the other areas to either remain the same or put even a different color into that. So I guess my answer, I said that was going to be an easy answer.
It makes a lot of sense.
By having the gels, it's like having a brush and being able to blot the color on there. In the digital suite, it's more of the situation of where you can control certain areas, but when you start ramping in a whole bunch of color, you very often get a lot of digital noise, which looks kind of like grain to most people,
yep.
And it detracts from the image. And you can also kind of see it. Now, probably someday, and that day may be very soon, they may be able to improve that to the point where you could actually do that. And believe me, the producers would be very happy about that because I believe we spent somewhere on the neighborhood of $60,000 for our color gels for this movie.
Wow. Significant.
I think the producers would be, you know, overjoyed that they didn't have to spend that kind of dough. This is a very rare situation, though, to use that much color.
Probably some of the films that you've done with Greg Araki were shot for the same amount that you paid for your gels on this one.
Indeed. No question about it. You know, on Mysterious Skin, I think, you know, Panavision gave us a camera for free.
Right.
To use because one of the executives believes in Mr. Araki's talent, and so they just donated a camera. That sort of thing you just don't get on the larger movies. You know?
Well, another thing I want to point out about shooting with, and I'm going to answer my own question here, but I want to see if you agree. Another thing about shooting with the color in the scene and creating all of that in the scene as intensively as you did is the fact that when you're on a set and everything is lit red, it brings out a certain kind of emotion in you naturally, whether it's a sense of aggression and violence and dread versus the scenes that you're shooting in the cool blue palette and everything feels much more subdued and late night and full moon and conspiratorial. So there really is an effect in that case. And you being a musician as well, we also understand that you can go into Pro Tools and you can add all the plugins you want to something, but the fact of the matter is, if a group of musicians gets together and has an amazing jam, you don't have to do anything in post. The thing is happening right there at the place, right?
I think you're spot on. I think it not only does it affect the thespians, of which you were an amazing one, but it also affects the whole crew. Even, you know, people were coming up to me and just going, this is the most amazing thing I've ever worked on. And I'm standing there and it's like 20 degrees below zero and it's snowing and it's horrific conditions. And I was, you know, taken aback because there's a person who's out there, you know, pulling cable through the snow and digging things out of the ice. And the guy's like, this is the most awesome thing I've ever worked on. And yes, you're right. Having it actually being practical is a much better way of going about it. I mean, I wonder how people do it, like, for instance, the movie 300, which a great amount of that was shot just simply against a green screen, right? How do you bring it as an actor or a cinematographer or whatever, when you're acting against a green wall. I find that probably a little more difficult than doing it practically.
No question. I look at those poor actors from the new Star Wars trilogy that came out, and I think they didn't have a fighting chance. I mean, you can only do so much, but really, when we were on those sets for Punisher and we were at these old cathedrals and these old dilapidated buildings, literally the fight sequence that happened in that rotted building that you guys had to go through, you don't have to use a lot of imagination to be in the middle of it. You're really in the middle of it, and you're going to react from a real honest place in the midst of that.
You are correct. And, you know, I hadn't actually stopped to think of it in that sense, especially in the way that it probably affected the actors. But I'm glad that you mentioned that, because it just reinforces the belief that Lexi and I had, that we really wanted to do something special on the set, and we really wanted to bring something unique to it. And I think we did. I think we've got something great there. I can't wait for December 5th. I can't wait to see what the general public thinks about it, you know? I don't know about you, but I love going to the theater, and I don't even look at the movie. I turn around and look at people watching the movie, you know?
I've seen people on the IMDb boards that talk about going to see the trailer in front of Saw and in front of Dark Knight and in front of all sorts of other films, and they were just there to see what the crowd reaction around them was going to be, and they reported back on that. So that's definitely always an exciting part. It's the call and response that you're looking for.
Exactly, and I think we may have a good opening day there, because I don't think there's anything even close to our genre of film that's opening that day.
No, so, definitely not.
You know, Bond will have already been out for some time, and Spirit's coming out afterwards. So I think we have a great slot. I think Lionsgate found a great place to put us.
I agree, and I think also that Quantum of Solace and The Spirit are also not the same movie. They may be one may be a comic film, one may be an action film, but Punisher is definitely a distinct film in so many ways. My personal experience with the film is that there are so many elements that are decidedly Punisher-esque that are specifically serving this film and not just trying to make another action hero film. The thing about the Punisher himself, and one of the reasons it's always been one of my favorite comic book heroes, is because he is just a guy. He is kind of like Batman, but he doesn't even have the crazy bat helmet, you know? It's just a guy who's got a vendetta, and he's got his guns, and he's got this faded logo on, and the world that he lives in is real, and this film was shot, like you said, very practically, so there's not any CG in it. There's no artificial giant green guys walking around that the actors are faking, and all of that has a sort of very direct, visceral impact when you watch it. It's why I love the old films, the old science fiction films where they didn't have computer-generated stuff, because somewhere in the world that had been built. So, you know, the old Star Wars movies, somewhere in the world those spaceships really existed, and there's a feeling that you get as well. I'm looking at an image of a thing that really is in the world. So Punisher I think it's going to have a real impact for that reason as well.
Yeah, I'm very excited, man. It's going to be, you know, obviously for myself, it's the largest film that I ever did. You know, Lexi really, really, really went out of her way to get me on board the film, because I think it's fairly well known at this point that the studio wanted, you know, someone that had done more big features before. And Lexi just believed in my vision and supported me and fought as she is wont to do, because she is a fighter, man. That's her whole life. She's been a fighter. She's a champion, you know, world champion kickboxer. So she is definitely a fighter. She fought for me for a couple of months it took. And I took numerous meetings with the studio and with Marvel and everyone. And while they liked me, you know, they quote unquote didn't necessarily see the Punisher on my reel. But I think in a way that might be a good thing, you know, because I wasn't necessarily bringing the baggage of some other action movie that I had recently done.
When I heard that they were doing a new Punisher movie, I was concerned that it was going to be some cheesy movie of the week. And then I started to see who was involved in the project, and I thought, this is interesting, because they're bringing in these independent filmmakers. Lexi Alexander had made a small film before that looked amazing. You had made a series of small budget films that had enormous impact. And I want to ask you, how do you think that working on something like What's Up Rockers, which is almost a documentary style film of a bunch of Mexican kids that are skateboarders in Hollywood, what experience from that could you bring to a film like Punisher?
Well, I'll tell you exactly what it was. Despite the fact that we were making, you know, and the budget is all over the place, I think the IMDb is completely wrong about it. The working budget that I saw was $35 million. Mm-hmm. And then I know that we added, you know, the extra couple of days in Vancouver, and that didn't help. That was pretty darn expensive, too. So it's upwards of $35 million, where the IMDb is reporting it at 20, which is an odd thing. But despite that, we still only had 40 days. And 40 days does not a big action movie make.
Yeah.
That's a really short time. You know, there's 60 days is, you know, an average bottom end of an action movie.
There's not a lot of margin for error there, especially when you've got blizzards and so on coming on.
Yeah, and what it really called for was that I had to go in there like and do guerrilla filmmaking in order to pull this off for Lexi. So what ended up happening was we would, you know, be with an hour left in the day, and Lexi would look at me and go, okay, you know, we got to go guerrilla on this. We just got to go for it. And I have years of experience starting from, you know, my early films. I shot 11 movies for Roger Corman, right? So
wow.
Starting from that raw background, which is, by the way, something aside from the actual date of our birth dates being the same, something that I share with Gaylan Hurd as well, because she started at Roger Corman. That's where she met James Cameron and, you know, et cetera. So, you know, Roger Corman, when they come in and say, you got 5 minutes. So, and you got to figure out how to shoot an action sequence in 5 minutes. So this is what the low budget and independent filmmaking thing probably brought best to me, was the ability to figure out easy ways to resolve production issues that appeared to be insurmountable.
I want to clarify something for people who may think that means that somehow the film is going to look cheap. I would walk on set as an actor, and there would be dozens, and I mean dozens, of lights and flags and gels, and this looked like as big a production as any I'd ever been on, as complex a production as any I'd ever been on. So you were pulling off some really complicated lighting rigs in a very short amount of time with very little to work with. You've mentioned it before, but the Montreal crew were total hardcore troopers. These guys were as alert as at midnight as they were as at 6 a.m, and they were really hauling ass for you. But I don't want people to get the idea that because we only had 40 days and because the budget wasn't as big as on some cases, that in any way that compromised the quality of what was going on.
Not at all. The quality is definitely there. It simply was the limitations of the minutes in the day that I had to pull off X amount of shots. And so that required also a great deal of pre-production planning. And, you know, my gaffer, a guy named Eames Gagnon, who's just this fantastic, fantastic gaffer in Montreal, he was also responsible for a lot of this stuff happening because he is so experienced and had worked on so many big movies. He came in there and had things laid out and had the lighting plots in order, and his rigging crew, who are the guys that come in before we get in there and hang the stuff up for us, they very, very seldom did we have to change stuff. I mean, we'd walk in, turn on the lights, maybe turn one or two off, and start shooting.
That's amazing.
That was a blessing in itself right there. And there probably were points, you know, when I was standing out in some slushy snowstorm thing where I was going, gosh, I wish I was back in my cozy little house in Burbank. Once the day was done and I was home with a nice glass of wine at the hotel, it didn't seem quite so bad. The worst part, of course, being that, you know, my daughter was born while I was up there and here in California. And I didn't get to see her until she was almost 2 months old. And that, you know, some of my relatives were aghast about that. They were just...
That's hardcore.
Yeah, but, you know, you just can't leave the show when you're the director of photography and go, you know, fly 3,000 miles and visit family. It doesn't make any sense.
And that happened to Ray as well, didn't it? Ray Stevenson had a baby during the process of the production.
Yeah, they actually had the baby just after wrap. So he's a lucky man. And she was up there, too. But, you know, my wife was in California, and, you know, it was a bit uncomfortable for me, and it's a little sad, but, you know, the baby has to wear clothes and eat, and someone has to pay for that. So that would be me.
Right on. Well, I commend you on your commitment on both fronts. That's a tough decision to have to make.
Look, it was so intense, and, you know, again, nodding back to the 40-day schedule, that during our weekends, it wasn't like, you know, I just said goodbye to Lexi and I went away and hung out and had fun at bars or anything. I would go back to the hotel, and she'd say, okay, I'll be up in about an hour.
Yeah.
You know, and then we'd get right back on the schedule. And John McCowan, who's our first assistant director, who also did a lovely job, he would, and he's actually become Lexi's husband in the interim, by the way.
Oh, I was wondering who she got married to. So all those guys that were talking about this fake story about her engagement and her wedding now know that she married one of my favorite people on set, a real solid guy. Well, that's good to know.
He's a great assistant director and a really, really great guy. What was I saying? Oh, yeah, we had these meetings. You know, I mean, it would literally be like, okay, well, that's a wrap. Okay, well, what are you doing tomorrow? Well, I plan to wake up about noon, because remember, we're shooting nights, so we're trying to sleep during the days, but it's awfully tough to do on the weekend, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you want to get up. So we get up and go out and grab a bite and then come back and start having meetings and start watching Blade Runner.
Yeah.
I also watched, not that I'm sure how this influenced the film, but I also watched Lawrence of Arabia about 15 or 20 times during the process as well. Something about the composition in Lawrence of Arabia just appeals to me beyond many other films. It has a lot to do with the 2:3:5 aspect ratio of the film, you know, the wide anamorphic scope of it, which is what we shot our picture in. We shot spherical. We didn't shoot anamorphic lenses, but we still kept that same aspect ratio. So I think I was looking for inspiration in, you know, in the composition of the film. And I do have to point out, I also had two extraordinary camera operators, Dominique and Dave, who were like my B and A camera operators, respectively. And they did a fantastic job of looking out for me. You know, everybody thinks that the cameraman is probably the guy that sits behind the camera. But frankly, most of the time, you're not. Most of the time, you're watching the lighting, trying to adjust the lighting, looking at what the camera operators are doing with the camera, and making certain that the director is getting the coverage and is happy with what coverage that they're getting. So it's a political job in as much as it's a hands-on job. And very seldom do I actually get to go out and operate the camera the whole time.
I think it was my last day of shoot, and I was supposed to be at the airport in an hour, and we're still shooting Pitsy's head getting blown up. But you came up to me and you said, man, you've got to go and ask Dave about some of his war stories as a camera operator. You wouldn't believe the stuff. And am I allowed
That's
to say?
Right.
Am I allowed to say?
I would suppose so, yeah. I don't see why not.
He was the camera operator that was there when Brandon Lee was shot.
That's correct. He was.
And you said you got to go ask him the story, and I said I don't even want to know. But then he told me about it, and it was unbelievable. Like just the shock that they felt and the things that they, you know, they must have experienced, and how that set was so cursed in so many different ways. But that guy has been through unbelievable situations, and so you had this guy gunning for you, and both of them were just amazing. They were nonstop, always on the ball, such kind people as well, you know, real
and
pros.
Very creative, and just, you know, really, you know, the whole idea, you know, it's a collaborative process, and the whole idea is to surround yourself. I think, you know, a smart director, someone like Lexi or Larry or whoever, a smart director surrounds themselves with people who are both eager and talented and wanting to better themselves and whatever they're involved in. And so I just made that my goal from the very beginning, from the very first thing that I shot many, 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 many years ago. And I mean, I didn't even have any idea. I didn't know which hole on the camera to look in, you know, at that
right.
point. But I hired really talented people. As a matter of fact, the first thing, this is ironic, the very first thing that I was, quote unquote, the director of photography on was an infomercial down in Orange County here in Los Angeles for this woman named June Kane Miller. Pretty funny. I'm sure that somewhere on YouTube or something, there's one or two episodes of that flopping around. But I was hired as the quote-unquote director of photography to shoot this, and frankly, I had very little knowledge. So I hired to be my camera operator this gentleman by the name of Brian Sweeney. Now, Brian Sweeney is the guy who actually was the director of photography for Second Unit on The Punisher with me.
Ah, Now I know why you were so excited about that. You said to me, wow, this guy who's shooting all this second unit stuff, I mean, we're talking heavy-duty action sequences. You said, it's like he's like my carbon copy. He's got my mind. He's thinking like I would think. And he's shooting stuff that's so cinematic and so advanced. And you were just really jazzed about that. You felt like you'd split into two and you could walk all over town.
Yeah, it's really easy when you're in second unit. And for those of you who don't know exactly what second unit does, second unit ordinarily on smaller things goes out and shoots establishing shots, you know, shots of a building that maybe someone's inside of, or a sunset or sunrise. Or on a larger film, second unit is actually responsible for a good deal of action sequences ordinarily. And that means that, you know, we'll come in there with first unit and shoot the dialogue bit before the gun battle starts. And then maybe we'll shoot the guns come out and start firing, and then we walk away from it. And then second unit comes in there and shoots everything else that has to do with that, the people getting blown up and the bullets and the whatever. Brian, you know, it was critically important for me, being this is, you know, hopefully a breakout for me of sorts in the larger budget world. Brian, I knew for, as I said, for many, many years, is a dear friend and really, you know, has worked with me on several things. He worked on What's Up Rockers with me, and he's been involved in several of my projects. And I knew that he was someone that I could trust and I could just walk away, and that whatever he ended up doing, I wouldn't cringe when I saw it in the movie. And that's a fact. As a matter of fact, he really went above and beyond. And they were working very long days. We were working very long days. He would come in there when we were working and they weren't. When he was off, he would come in with his digital camera and his light meter and pay attention to what I was doing on the set, just so that when he got in there on that set himself, he'd be able to match exactly what I'd done. And in this instance, where, you know, we 40 days to shoot, so the second unit had 20 days. It's kind of like we had 60 days to shoot almost.
I remember being in the trailers, getting my makeup adjusted or whatever, and hearing about the guys who were out at the second unit the night before, and they're just like, you're so lucky you weren't there last night. But those guys were out there shooting for 2-3 straight weeks. I mean, that's a lot of action. That's a lot of stunts going on in that environment and everything.
I've noticed some of the things people are coming about on the internet about the movie, because the trailers that have been shown are a lot of action, right? I mean, it's just a lot of shooting and, you know, chandelier hanging and that sort of thing. But the fact of the matter is, there's a great deal of drama in the picture. So while they were shooting so many things blowing up, you know, we were really getting into Frank's head.
And that's the thing. Second unit was off shooting 3 weeks worth of action stuff. But the entire 40 days, we were on the set shooting all dramatic stuff, all dialogue. So it's definitely not something that should be mistaken for just a bloodbath gore fest of people shooting at each other. There's a strong mixture of both elements.
Yeah, there really is. It's fantastic. It's neither a full action movie, nor is it a full drama. It's a great mix of the two. And, you know, when you see a lot of that action stuff, you can thank Mr. Brian Sweeney for making it look like it belongs in our movie.
Real nice. So what's next for you, Steve? What's going on after this?
I'm going out to the desert tomorrow to shoot a little commercial, and I got another little commercial next week, and just hoping that our industry can get back to doing feature films fairly soon, hoping that your contemporaries will figure out what they want to do about their labor dispute.
Yep.
And can straighten that out so that we can all get back to work soon. You don't have any insight for us on that, do you, Karam?
Well, I can tell you that there's this thing called the internet that came out, and the television stations, studios figured out that they can actually play stuff in full resolution in real time back. And then they also figured out that they could add commercials to those things. And then they thought, oh, neat. We don't have to pay for this programming like we did back on TV. And the actor said, but that's still my work. And if you're making ad money from it, don't you think I should get a little kickback for using what I do? Because, you know, actors don't make as much as people would think, except for the big, big A-list people. So we have to establish what this new internet thing is all about and what it means. I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon. and there's no provisions right now.
No, it seems to be hanging in there, you know. My only hope is that we will get on with it. I say either strike or get off the internet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what I tell you is tell the producers that, because we'd be happy to go back to work. Believe me, I don't think actors are the kind of people who like being out of work.
No doubt about that.
Just tell the producers, be fair about it, be cool, and we'll move on. No problem.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's going to have to come to head sometime soon, I would think.
Yeah, we definitely want to get it over with. And I mean, this is exactly that you would have thought that after the writers pointed out this problem and sorted it out, it would be a quick solution to get to the actors. But no, they want to take it all the way back to the grindstone at the beginning. So I'm just a working guy, or a non-working guy most of the time. But that's, you know,
now especially, yeah.
But we have to sort of sit around, and we can stand in picket lines and do all of that. But ultimately, this stuff is a battle that happens in boardrooms in between a bunch of suits. So we have to sit and watch as well.
True.
I did want to point out that you shot a video for one of the coolest songs of the year by TV on the Radio. Want to tell me really quick about that experience and you with shooting videos for bands?
Yeah, well, you know, I've shot in my career, I've shot about 300 music videos. So I've kind of crossed the board of all different types of genres of music, from metal to country music to now this very interesting band, TV on the Radio, which was shot about, I guess it was about a month and a half ago in New York. And you know, they're an awesome band, and the director, this guy named Petro, and he's really awesome. He had this idea, and here it was, again, if you look at it, it's primarily a green screen thing. There were a few real elements in it, but the majority of it was green screen. It was shot on the Red high-definition camera, and so it's a very modern approach to what we did. And he's kind of a madman and had just this crazy idea of dancing cops and band members turning into bodybuilders with animal heads. So it's called Golden Age is the name of the song in the video, and I think it's pretty awesome. And I'm very proud that I've been able in my career to do a lot of different things, commercials, music videos, and movies on all different levels. I've been a really, really blessed and fortunate person, because I know there are lots and lots of people that have come out of, you know, film school and have wanted to be a cinematographer, and they haven't necessarily gotten the breaks or whatever and gotten the opportunities that I have to do it. And I didn't go to film school. I didn't do anything. I just kind of said, okay, I'll try that. Let me give it a shot. I think the biggest advice I have for anyone that wants to, you know, live their dream is focus on the dream, live true and try and do everything that you can in order to make it happen. But then once you're finally presented the opportunity to do it, make certain that the people around you are aware of what you actually know how to do. Because when people see that you don't necessarily have the abilities, they'll help you. But if you don't have the ability and you try to do it and you blow it, you're never going to get another chance.
Right. Stay modest, and then you'll learn from your elders. But,
yeah, just stay real with it, man. You know, it's worked so far for me. And you know, I'm a young guy. I'm only 46 years old. I got tons of time to go as a DP.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do.
Woo. Hey, by the way, Karen, very exciting news for your fans is the fact that they're going to see your lovely face within the first minute of the movie.
Oh, fun.
That's all I'll say.
Fun. Well, I haven't seen the movie, so everybody out there who's excited about The Punisher, you're probably not any more excited than I am. I can't wait to see this thing on the big screen. There's so many amazing people behind it. I can tell you firsthand, as a Punisher fan, I was on the set. I watched how intricate and devoted everybody was to this. This was not a phone-it-in kind of movie where they're like, oh, big budgets, yeah, what's the Hulk, whatever. Everybody in this was really into it, and I'm just totally fired up about this project, and I hope that in the end it's seen for all that it was.
Well, I think it will be, buddy, and you did a great job, by the way. I think your fans are going to be thrilled by your performance.
Hey, thanks a lot for that, and yeah, I look forward to us working together again sometime real soon.
Hey, man, you let me know. I'm there, okay?
Right on, right on. Thanks for your time, man. I hope everybody gets a lot out of this. I sure did. And this is a guy I spent, you know, 40 days and 40 nights with, and I'm still learning stuff. So thanks so much for your time, Steven, and keep on kicking ass out there.
Anytime, my brother, anytime.
And that's how we do it here at thecarumcast.com. I want to thank cinematographer Steve Gaynor once again for being on the show. Please send your letters and your comments, thoughts, feedback, gripes, social security numbers to info@karamcast.com. That's KeramCast.com. Thanks again for listening. See you next time.